Alexandra is a qualitative research manager at the Louisiana Public Health Institute. She works across several areas, including tobacco-free living, primary care capacity building, maternal child and family health, and behavioral health. And Alex, I guess as she goes by, is also the co-chair of the Violence Prevention Working Group. She's currently completing a dissertation, at Tulane right here in New Orleans, looking at the post-disaster quality of life and migration behavior. So, welcome, Alex.
All right. Good afternoon. I'll be presenting findings from the Displaced New Orleans Residents Qualitative Study. There's my chair walking in the room right now. And so since the whole gang's here, I'm going to just acknowledge Caitlin Canfield, who, raise your hand, was my research assistant on this project, and Dr. Mark Van Landingham, who is the reason that this happened and is serving as my co-chair for my dissertation. So I'm glad you guys are here. And everybody else. So I have no financial relationships to disclose. On August 29th, 2005, Hurricane Katrina made landfall on the Gulf Coast just east of the city of New Orleans in Burris, Louisiana, as a Category 3 with sustained winds of around 125 miles per hour. It was thought that approximately 80% of the residents left the city in advance of the approaching storm, and I actually happened to be one of them. It has been estimated that 1.5 million people along the coast were displaced temporarily by Hurricane Katrina. 300,000 were permanently displaced, and of those remaining permanently displaced, approximately 140,000 of them were New Orleanians who did not return to the city, or about a third of the city's pre-Katrina population. Now, migration is just one of a broad set of potential adaptive responses to individual and households engage in when they're dealing with stresses such as disaster events. In the case of Katrina, residents with low socioeconomic status, African Americans, and families with children were less likely to return. This is in part because disasters often exacerbate and reinforce inequitable social arrangements. In addition to social and cultural disruptions, the economic losses from disasters are not distributed equally among communities and individuals. Following Hurricane Katrina, the RAND Institute, University of Michigan, and Tulane University conducted the Displaced New Orleans Residents Survey. DNORS was designed to examine the current location, well-being, and plans of people who lived in the city of New Orleans at the time of Hurricane Katrina. Fielded in 2008, DNORS completed a detailed survey assessment of over 1,000 households that were affected by Hurricane Katrina. And my household actually happened to be one of them. So recognizing that surveys fail to capture the rich experience of post-disaster recovery, the Displaced New Orleans Residents Qualitative Study was initiated in 2010 using a small subsample of DNORS participants from New Orleans, Texas, Louisiana, and the Mississippi Gulf Coast area. So the key questions that I'm going to touch on today in this talk with the time that's allowed are, how do people fare after a disaster? Is there a difference in health and well-being of those who return versus those who do not? In other words, do people do better when they stay or leave? And second, what is the relationship between well-being and post-disaster migration behavior? Do people's perceptions of well-being influence their decision to stay or out-migrate? To ensure maximum variation, we used a stratified sample based on whether informants returned or outmigrated. And within each of those categories, we further stratified into binary categories by degree of damage and socioeconomic status. So were they more privileged or were they less privileged? And we determined that by whether they were at the median income level at the time of Katrina, which in New Orleans was actually lower than the national level of $26,000. And then whether they experienced high damage or low damage. As you can see, and our goal was to interview at least 5 in each category, but as you can see, it was very challenging to locate low-income individuals who had experienced low damage residing outside of the city of New Orleans. And so these are the demographics of our final sample. We completed 50 interviews, 21 with people who returned to New Orleans and 29 with people that out-migrated. So informants were asked about their life before Katrina, their evacuation Katrina experience, their reason for returning or not returning, the impact of Katrina on quality of life, and if they had children, the impact of Katrina on their children's quality of life, obstacles to recovery and sources of resiliency and support, and perceptions of the future. Interviews were recorded and transcribed verbatim, and 40% of the interviews were double-coded to ensure an inter-reader reliability of 95% or greater. And my co-coder is sitting right there. So this map shows where returnees lived at the time of Katrina. And this map shows where out-migrants lived at the time of Katrina. After a catastrophe, the multidimensionality of recovery involves tremendous resources, including housing, healthcare, education, employment, childcare, and informal sources of support that individuals normally draw on for help, such as families and community-based organizations. However, the scope and scale and duration of a catastrophe such as Katrina greatly diminish the availability of these resources. The concept of vulnerability provides a foundation for understanding the impact of disasters on well-being, as well as the spatial and temporal patterns of post-disaster migration. Several studies have demonstrated a disproportionate impact on Black and low-income communities. The elderly are also particularly vulnerable to disasters. Other factors that influence social vulnerability include lack of access to resources, limited access to political power and representation, social capital, including social networks and connections, beliefs and customs, frail and physically limited individuals, and the type and density of infrastructure and lifelines. As one informant in Texas explained, the water receded, but the storm never went away. There have been problems ever since that day, and I don't think they will ever go away. So, how did returnees and out-migrants fare post-Katrina? We identified several themes that impacted post-disaster well-being and shaped migration behavior, and I'm going to focus on five for today's talk. The power of decision-making and autonomy, recovery and isolation, sense-making, sense of purpose, and sense of security. The greater a person's decision-making and autonomy over their return or out-migration, the more likely they were to report a higher sense of well-being. And what I mean by this is that the greater an individual's ability to choose whether they migrated or not and where, the greater they reported their sense of well-being 5 years later. For example, there was a marked difference between a cluster of individuals I interviewed in Austin, Texas, versus those that I interviewed in Houston. The Austin individuals were predominantly white, high SES, and had experienced low damage. They exercised a high degree of autonomy in their decision-making to out-migrate. By contrast, many individuals in Houston were African-American, low-income, and middle SES, and had experienced high damage. Their decision-making power was often limited by financial constraints and other barriers. Many of them indicated a low level of well-being 5 years later. One key factor influencing autonomy was whether an individual was in the caretaking role. Early studies showed that families with children were less likely to return to New Orleans after Katrina, but caretaking can span the life cycle. For example, one couple who originally were from New Orleans East evacuated with their elderly parents. They decided to settle in Texas in order to take care of their parents' health needs, even though they wanted to return to New Orleans. They purchased a house right before the Great Recession. They were both forced to take an early retirement, are upside down on their mortgage, and have spent their life savings caring for their parents. Both husband and wife talked about high levels of stress, and the wife spoke openly about her depression. Conversely, several informants shared how they felt pressured by family members to return to New Orleans, even though they did not want to. For example, one informant shared how she settled successfully in New Mexico with her 5 children, even though she and her children were thriving in their new environment. She let them talk her into moving back to New Orleans. After their return, her children started doing poorly in school, and her eldest son dropped out of high school and was murdered in front of their house. Now, high social vulnerability following a disaster does not necessarily correspond with a low sense of well-being. Many low-income informants, particularly African-American women, discussed the importance of religion and faith during the recovery process from Katrina. For many low-income informants, Katrina was just one of a long series of shocks in their lives, and not necessarily the worst, as illustrated by my previous example. But because of the lack of decision-making power and autonomy, for example, several informants told me that during their evacuation from New Orleans, they were not told where they were headed until their planes took off from Louis Armstrong Airport. Informants often coped by giving it up to God. Individuals that experienced a loss of decision-making and autonomy after Katrina and substituted faith tend to report a higher level of well-being than those that did not. And they also reported less depressive symptoms and health issues. Another key theme that emerged around well-being was this notion of recovery and isolation. Informants that reported a sense of connection and community often reported a higher sense of well-being versus those that reported feeling isolated in their recovery, regardless of whether they returned or not, or whether they were of low or high SES. Many informants reported being isolated as a result of loss of social networks. That was particularly true among low-income African-American informants whose extended families were scattered across the country. Informants also reported a sense of isolation when they encountered structural barriers such as to recovery, such as challenges with foreclosure or barriers rebuilding. But even informants that appeared to be in stable situations of recovery reported feelings of isolation. One informant reported being so angry about his perceived abandonment by friends and family during recovery that his wife was shocked to find out that he felt this way 5 years later. An extreme case of isolation was the woman whose son was murdered. Not only was she overwhelmed by the burden as a caregiver and her grief, but she felt extremely isolated. Now, New Orleans was not a therapy culture pre-Katrina, but post-Katrina, there continues to be a critical shortage of mental health services, particularly for the uninsured. So recovery and isolation was a much more common among informants that out-migrated than those that returned. Several informants in Houston who experienced high Katrina-related damage appeared to be more isolated and depressed than individuals that returned to New Orleans who had also suffered high damage regardless of income. The loss of social and professional networks was especially difficult for these informants, as well as the fact that their new communities lacked the unique culture of New Orleans. Informants, such as the woman quoted here, that experienced stigma firsthand, reported a lower sense of well-being than those that felt that they were part of their community, their new community. This is in line with the literature, such as Paxton et al., that found greater social support was a protective factor against post-traumatic stress symptoms. Another key theme that emerged was sense-making, the importance of processing and coping, as noted from this quote. Mental health continues to be a challenge for many informants, particularly for informants that experienced Katrina firsthand, meaning that they did not initially evacuate, that had family members that experienced it firsthand or were hurt or killed, that had a history of depression and/or anxiety. By extension, several informants noted the physical toll of stress. One informant told us, "It probably cost me a few years of my life, you know. I mean, I didn't have any serious health issues in terms of high blood pressure or other byproducts of that." She attended a free medical fair at the zoo following Katrina and waited all day to be seen. And when she was finally seen, she noted that they kept taking my blood pressure over and over and over again because they didn't believe me, because I'm 5'1", I weigh 110, 115. I'm not overweight, I'm not African American, and I had 180 over 110 blood pressure. So they did not know with me. I didn't fit any categories. I found out that even small children had high blood pressure here. Everybody, it was just crazy. Another key coping strategy employed by informants was the juxtaposition of self to the other or the self in time, such as it was worse for other people than me. I practiced that one, by the way. And a variation on this theme is, look at where we are now, as noted by this quote right here. Informants that discussed having a sense of purpose following Katrina also discussed having a greater sense of well-being. For example, these are two quotes from women that I interviewed. One of them was a hairdresser who basically engaged in giving haircuts, but really did a lot of counseling for her community. And this woman got very involved in taking care of people. She ended up relocating to Baton Rouge and took care of people during Katrina as well as Gustav, and then doing a lot of volunteer work. So violence and personal safety. So the sense of safety came up a lot. Were especially important to informants that outmigrated 5 years after Katrina, regardless of their income. We heard this a lot when we were in Texas. In contrast, for many returnees, these issues were primarily discussed by those of lower SES who tended to live in high crime areas. Non-returnees, regardless of SES, were happy with the level of personal safety and the lack of crime in the communities they experienced. In fact, a lot of people we talked to would say, I don't tell anybody in New Orleans this, but I'm never going back because the crime is just too bad. And it wasn't that violence and crime doesn't touch everybody in New Orleans, but it affects everybody here. And that was a really big thing in terms of people's decisions about their quality of life and in terms of their decision to stay out of the city and not return. So, the way forward. Well-being in a post-disaster context is an important conceptual and policy tool for successful post-disaster recovery. Increasing focus and resources are being placed on disaster preparedness, but gaps remain in how individuals and communities fare after a disaster. There is an opportunity cost to individuals and communities when people out-migrate that requires greater research. The disruptive effects of disasters on individuals can be quite long-lasting. Findings from this study illustrate that individuals who experienced a higher level of decision-making power and autonomy, a greater sense of community and support, a higher sense of coping and sense of purpose, and or a stronger sense of safety reported a greater sense of well-being whether they returned or out-migrated. But for those that out-migrated, a higher sense of well-being was reinforced. A higher sense of well-being reinforced their decision to out-migrate. Now, there's a couple limitations, of course, to the study, and the first is that it's a qualitative study. I cannot extrapolate these findings to a larger population. And in addition, I only did these interviews at one time point following Katrina, so I had no baseline pre-Katrina data, and I had no way to look longitudinally. It'd be very interesting to talk to these people now at the 10-year mark and see how they're doing. And I really do feel, and what I've learned out of this and what my dissertation is actually focusing on, is looking at quality of life post-disaster as not a static variable, but as a dynamic variable. I don't think we do a very good job of measuring it. I think that we need to continue to really explore post-disaster quality of life and its relationship to post-disaster recovery. And ultimately, I would like to see better instruments developed to measure this going forward to not only help people that return to their communities have a higher quality of life, but also to help people that out-migrate into new communities to thrive and do well following a disaster. So that's it for my questions. Thank you.